720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I normally say I hope you're outside enjoying some of that sunshine, but it's not so sunshiny today. It's a little chilly and cooling off a little bit, looking kind of overcast. But nonetheless, our February selves will thank us for enjoying that warmer weather now. Lots to do today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. As per usual, we're going to be talking a little bit later in the show about having not a case of the Mondays, but a case of the Smundays, of course, dreading going back to work and what we can do about it. And we're going to be taking a look at here we are several years outside of the housing market crash, and we're going to take a look at the Chicago zip codes that have recovered the best and not so much. So we're going to be checking in with our friends at Crane's Chicago Business about that. But right now we're joined by another friend, Carrie Wigginton from Chicago Tribune and Blue Sky Innovation, who's joining us today. Hi, Carrie. How are you?
Hi, I'm good.
Thanks for being with us today. Well, so you wrote this really interesting piece. Everybody, you can go find this at chicagotribune.com. It's about brain training apps, which is something we have talked a lot about on this show, particularly a few months ago when there were some shenanigans called on them and said, hey, look, you can't be making these claims if you got to have the data to back it up. So we had a talk about that a few months ago. But you've written this piece about how to actually develop your brain and what you want to do if you really do want to try to up your brain game a bit. Tell us a bit about that.
Right. So basically, as you were saying, the apps don't really help you translate that into real world brain training outside of the games you're playing. So the only things that studies have actually shown do work are exercise and meditation. And exercise does it both in direct and indirect ways. It does things like reduces your insulin resistance, helps you, keep your blood pressure low, and keeps you from sort of having a higher risk of stroke. And if you have sort of mini strokes that you don't even notice, that can directly mean you get dementia. And so if you exercise, it reduces those things specifically. But it also, your muscles release a chemical that actually helps your the part of your brain that is controlling memory, like the hippocampus. It actually grows new brain cells. So that gets larger and helps your memory actually directly from the exercise.
Well, I'll take
and
that.
Also, yeah, it's like you're exercising and you're not specifically trying to increase your memory, but it does it, after the fact.
There's a really interesting study that you mentioned in the piece that you wrote. It's from the National Institute of Aging that really dives very deeply into what you're talking about. That was really fascinating, a bit of a rabbit hole, really, once you start kind of digging through it.
Right. Yeah. And so it's like if you exercise and your muscles start releasing, it's aerobic exercise. I should clarify that. I don't think they're specifically talking about just sort of taking a walk. But if you're getting your heart rate up, it actually makes your hippocampus sort of, it increases the activity. And so that's the part that's directly related to your memory and your memory storage.
All right. So a little bit cardio is going to help us all with our brains.
Exactly. Yeah.
and then mindfulness was the other piece of that, which I think is really interesting because I think that's still something a lot of people resist or just think they know about anecdotally. And therefore they say, oh, it's not for me. But more and more, I think that's really entering a mainstream conversation, which I'm excited to hear.
Right. I can specifically attest to the benefits of meditation. I use the Headspace app every day. And what it doesn't sort of seem like it's helping exactly at the moment, but if you don't do it, then you notice that your mind wanders, maybe you're getting a little bit more stressed out. But science actually shows that the prefrontal cortex for people who meditate, it thickens. And when that thickens, it increases your ability to be aware of what you're doing. So you'll notice if your mind's wandering and you can sort of see that, stop, get back to what you're doing. It also helps with decision making and concentration. And then as the prefrontal cortex grows, your fear center, the amygdala, it actually shrinks. And so that means that your fight or flight, your stress levels, those actually don't react as much. So you have less anxiety, less depression. Your heart rate is actually lower, which overall reduces your stress levels. And so that's actually documented by science from people who have trained in meditation.
You know, my yoga teacher, I'm sure, is listening to this going, I told you all.
Yeah, it's exactly. I mean, it's shown to be pretty much as effective as some antidepressants.
Wow, isn't that so interesting? So I'm glad to see that things like mindfulness, meditation, yoga, those things are all entering more of a mainstream conversation, and more traditional, medical practitioners are recognizing those benefits. I think that's really, really important. Tell us more about that Headspace app that you mentioned.
So Headspace is something I've been using personally for about a year and a half. And so it's at, if you can get it on iTunes, it's headspace.com or just the Headspace app. And it gives you 10 free 10-minute sessions at the beginning just to try it out, see if it works for you. And I was sold after, I think, 3 sessions. So I immediately bought into the subscription. I did a month, and then I've done a year since then. But it gives you specific packs that are the guy who narrates it is a former Buddhist monk, and he also has a British accent, which is very awesome and helpful. Right. But you can do specific things about creativity, focus, depression, anxiety. There are single packs that help for sleep. Everyone I've told about this app, they sort of can't live without it at this point. But every time I do the sleep app, I can't get to sleep. You start this session and he just sort of guides you through a meditation session. And I'm always asleep, like before he's even done. I'll wake up with my headphones on in the middle of the night.
How interesting. Well, I'm sitting here downloading it as we're talking, so I'm going to give it a try too.
It's amazing.
I think that's really, really interesting. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us all about this. We will keep admiring all of your work at ChicagoTribune.com. Carrie Wigginton, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great. Thanks. Glad to be here.
All right. My friends, we will be back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. It's kind of gray Saturday morning, afternoon-ish. Hope you're still enjoying a little of the weather while it's still warm enough to do so. Like I always say, my friends, our February selves will thank us for spending time outside now. Still lots to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, of course. Plenty to do, as usual. We're joined now by Paul Ziobro, who has written about, he's from the Wall Street Journal, and he's written about, he writes all about consumer products, and he's a retail reporter. And it is that time of year where we start that conversation, because we don't have enough to talk about in the world right now, of course. It's that time of year where we start talking about Thanksgiving and retail and when the stores are going to open for the Black Friday shopping and all that good stuff. And that has become a very contentious point in years past and just recent years as we see stores that are opening or staying open on Thanksgiving. And a lot of conversation opens about whether or not, big retailers should allow their employees to go home and spend time with their families on Thanksgiving, or if the profits are worth it to them to be open all the time. But it seems like a little bit of the tide is turning and more retailers and more malls are closing on Thanksgiving. And so Paul joins us now to talk about that. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So tell us what has inspired this shift, really, where we're starting to see some retailers kind of go, no, maybe not, maybe too far. Is it kind of the court of public opinion is turning the tide, or is it something else?
Well, they like to say that they're listening to their workers and they're saying that they don't want to work on Black Friday, which that very well may be the case. But at the very end of the day, these are businesses, and I think it's a business decision more than anything else. What they realize is opening that day, three, four years ago, and when it first started, they did get a lift in sales for the overall season, which is what you want to do. But as each year went on, it seemed that being open on Thanksgiving merely just shifted sales to one day from another, whether it was the Black Friday or the Saturday after Black Friday or from earlier in the week. It was just, shifting it around. And what's the point of that if you're not growing the overall pie? So I think what's interesting is not the retailers that have always kind of withheld being open on Thanksgiving. It's finally we're seeing the ones that are backtracking after a couple of years of testing it out and being unwilling to cede any ground to the competition. They're reeling it in. They're saying, it wasn't worth it being open that day. We didn't get the big lift in sales. And our employees are going to be happier as a result as well.
It is really interesting. The Mall of America is one that you note in your story about. You know, that's such a big one. When we think of malls, it doesn't get much bigger than that. That has said, you know what, we're not going to be open. We're not going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's also another regional mall chain who said that they're going to, you know, close all their malls, you know, except, you know, if there's a Macy's attached to it or a JCPenney that does want to do a Thanksgiving open, you know,
right.
They're usually on the outside, one of the anchor sources, and they can do it. But some of the other chains we hear, a regional electronic chain, H.H. Gregg, you know, they've been open the last 4 years, so they're going to be closing on Thanksgiving, so they're going to close for the first time. And Office Depot is also closing for the first time in 3 years. So those are the interesting cases. I mean, you might not think of Office Depot as like the hotbed of Thanksgiving and Black Friday activity, but they do have those doorbusters for some electronics that are coveted around the time of the year. But, you know, like they said that they looked at, you know, their business and the personal reasons for doing so, and they outweighed being open.
Well, and you know, we always think of REI, who really really made a point last year to
yeah.
say, hey, look, we're not doing this. It's not safe for employees. We want them to have a minute with their families. We're not doing this. And they were not open on Thanksgiving and not open on Black Friday.
Right. And, you know, when I see that, you know, I think that that's a, you know, very – it plays into that this is also – can be a marketing move. If you're just so – if you're just not going to do it, like, why not spin it into something positive and kind of get some credit amongst the public about that?
Yeah.
I mean, you're still, you know, a lot of the large retailers, you know, the Walmarts, the Targets, the Best Buys, they haven't come out. In the coming weeks, they're going to be announcing their Thanksgiving and Black Friday hours. And you can probably expect that they're going to hold on to those Thursday openings. I don't know if they're going to creep earlier and earlier as they have been, but in that realm where the big Black Friday players, I mean, they're fighting for market share. And if Walmart's going to be open for, you know, 2-3 hours or having their doorbusters 2-3 hours earlier than Target or Best Buy, like there is an opportunity to lose market share. So I don't think that they're going to their employees are still going to have to work on Thanksgiving.
Yeah. And is it true? I mean, this is your area of expertise. Do you feel like there's any truth to this narrative that's emerged in the last few years that, you know, there aren't really that many deals to be had on Black Friday anymore? It's really about Cyber Monday. It's really kind of later in the season, closer to the actual holiday when you see those
yeah.
better deals.
There's no shortage of deals during the holiday season, and you'll start seeing them earlier in November. You'll start seeing some nice doorbuster deals throughout the week of Black Friday usually, and then you do have the online deals, the Cyber Monday, and even closer to the holiday. So, I mean, I think there are some good deals to be had. You have to kind of cherry pick and be smart about what you're buying, but. There is certainly some evidence that it's not the best day to buy certain toys. I mean, certain items, but there are good deals to be had. But I mean, if you want to be a last minute shopper and wait for the retailers to get desperate, that can always be the case as well. I mean, the other thing that we haven't hit on as well is just the online element of this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, everybody's got a website, everybody can shop online. Even these retailers that are closing on Thanksgiving after a couple years of being open, I mean, they can still do a lot of sales. And all these other retailers that are open on Thanksgiving, they offer a lot of the same doorbuster deals from that day online. So, I mean, it really raises the question, like, what is the point of being open on Thanksgiving? And the last couple of years, as I've gone out in those days and talked to people waiting in line, it really runs the gamut from, like, you know, this is kind of a tradition of things for the shoppers who are waiting in line. It's like, it's tradition, you know, I bring my family, my friends out here, we make a day of it. Some people just want to buy that 60-inch TV for, you know, whatever, $299,
mm-hmm.
and they're willing to sacrifice a day and a half or more of camping out. But it always boggles my mind that you can get these same deals, for the most part, online, yet there are still people lining up. But like I said, it's kind of ingrained in a lot of shopping habits, and it is a annual tradition for a lot of families.
Yeah. I, you know, it pains me when I see things reaching levels about safety when we're talking about that, when we're talking about people being injured after, you know, in hot pursuit of a television deal or something like that. But, well, you know what? I'm going to be on the air right here in the station, at the station on Black Friday all afternoon. So I may have to give you a call back and check in with you and see how things are going that day.
All right.
Sounds
good.
Well,
you can do some shopping from your desk, maybe.
Exactly. I'll shop from here in the studio. Exactly. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Paul Ziobro from Wall Street Journal. We will talk to you on Black Friday.
All right. Thanks, Amy.
All right. Thanks so much. Have a great Saturday. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, and we'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Monday, 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Playing that song, of course, because, you know, we all know that phrase, having a case of the Mondays. We all have had that.
I've never heard that.
That's a thing we've all had. It's true. It's real. And, you know, there's a really interesting piece that's in Bloomberg right now, really recognizing that for what it is, that it really can create a lot of anxiety, not just on Monday, getting back into your weekly routine after a couple of days off, but in fact, on Sunday nights. I don't know about the rest of you, but I have totally experienced that when I had kind of more 9-to-5 type hours. Sunday nights, I would have really bad anxiety and like insomnia, knowing like, oh man, there's so much stuff awaiting me in just a few hours. On the other side of this alarm, on the other side of this sleep, I know there's going to be so much stuff. But it's a thing. It's kind of a little bit of epidemic level. So Bloomberg has written about that. But there's a plan they have also attached, because I'm all about the solutions here. I don't like to just complain without a solution attached to it. And there is a plan attached to this from our friends at Bloomberg about how to take back your Sunday and really, really make it the Sunday fun day that it should be. They're all about get yourself organized on Friday so that you don't have to kind of scramble to have that. I mean, I know a lot of people that kind of like that Sunday evening, check email, look at stuff, kind of make your list. But Bloomberg is recommending do it Friday so you can your brain can let that go, which makes sense, right? Our brains are not really wired to hang on to unfinished stuff happily. Our brains like to finish things off. So if you kind of put the stamp on Friday by making your list and getting yourself organized, make your Monday list, you know what you got to do so you can just kind of not freak out on Sunday night. We're calling this, from our friends at Bloomberg, the Smundays is what that is.
They also advise that you get to bed early-ish on Friday.
On Friday, which I thought was interesting.
So, yeah, their plan for avoiding that stress on Sunday is to, yeah, it starts on Friday right after work, as you said. And I don't know how realistic that is. I mean, I think a lot of people just hear this and say, okay, here's what I'll do, not do that.
Right.
But it does intrigue me. I like that they've really got this thing mapped out. Like,
They've thought about this quite a bit. We're all about helping your brain today on the show.
Because I did totally identify with that headline that just said stop Monday from ruining your Sunday. And I thought, yeah, that's what always
it
happens.
Does.
I mean,
it's
I don't have
back
a,
your mind.
I, like you, don't have the 5-day
the
schedule.
Corporate hours, yeah.
Yeah, the corporate hour. But that feeling is, I think everybody can relate to.
Yeah. And I remember reading a sleep study a few months ago that was about how you really can't make up for sleep. Once you've lost it, you've lost it. So it's really, they were really advocating the idea of keep to, you know, they're going to be late nights and things like that, but keep to a sleeping schedule as best you can and really try to give yourself a routine around sleep. And the reason that study had come up is because people are having so many conversations right now about labor relations and shift workers and things like that, about how it's very difficult to plan your life if you know, are waiting for a schedule to come out in retail or something like that, that might change, you know, or food service or something that might change vastly and have you working very late one night and very early the next day or something like that. And so there was a sleep study attached to that, talking about how, you know, it's really important. It's valuable just as human beings and anti-aging and to for brain health and cognitive function to keep as regular of a sleep schedule as possible. Our friends at Bloomberg agree to combat the Sunday night stress. So they kind of break it down in like a timeline. So they're saying 5 p.m. on Friday, organize yourself, go to bed at a reasonable hour on Friday. Then on Saturday, do all of your chore things, do all of the household things, or go hang out at a radio station, whatever. Go do the chore things. And then they say afternoon, happy thoughts. Happy thoughts. They're all about, like, you know, keep it positive, but recognize the things that you might be dreading, things like that. But they've even gone so far as to recommend like a short positive mantra if you're starting to be concerned about it. Just like keep your Saturday quite free. And then they even recommend a relatively, they say for dinner, keep it small. Like, they have really, really thought about this in such great detail. I was so surprised to read this story, which is so interesting. Like, this is the midpoint of your weekend. Keep it real, people.
Yeah, here's another thing. Not going to do that.
Also not going to do that. Right.
I'll decide the size of my dinner. Right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bloomberg. I will tell you.
I don't know. It's just in my heart, my reaction is antagonistic. But I recognize the value in this.
I know you're looking out for us, Bloomberg. But
I saw it and I thought, I love this.
Yeah.
And yet when you go through point by point, it's like, don't want to
do
that.
Nope.
Don't really want to do that.
Right.
But I also have a little bit of a hard time relating because, like I said, my hours are different than what they've laid out, which does change everything. Like instead of having 2 days in a row off, I usually get 2 days separate from each other. So your Friday leads into your Sunday. You know what I mean? Like the day you work and then that night and then it feels like Sunday already. So it kind of forces you to enjoy that Sunday a little more. I found for myself.
I agree with that. And I also think there is a different kind of anxiety on those of us who have different kind of weekends. So like I have a weekday that's my Saturday and then I have my Sunday is later in the week. And so I feel like that really irritates my friends.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, hey, it's Saturday. Want to do something? I'm like, as you know, I am at the radio station all day. This is what I do. Saturday is kind of my Thursday.
Yeah, but how about mid-morning on Tuesday? That'd be really fun.
Right,
are you free then?
I'm like, hey, do you want to have brunch on, like, Wednesday? That sounds cool. And people are like, what's wrong with you?
Of course not.
Of course not. Right, right. I think that, like, it's both stressful to people who do keep 9 to 5 hours when I'm like, no, weekends are quite busy for me, in fact. Because they want to hang out then, but then it's equally stressful when I'm like, Wednesday afternoon? No? Okay, fine. Right. So then Bloomberg continues, and they talk about Sunday. It's all about, they say, take the brunch, do the brunch. It's not just a trend. It's all about doing it. But then they say, afternoon, get out and do something. Get out of the house, plan a group outing, do something cool. They even go so far as to say, and I'm telling you, Bloomberg has really put a lot of thought into this. They say, late evening on Sunday, journal. They're like, just journal.
Nice.
Let that anxiety out. It's going to take a minute to shift away from all this. And it also says it might seem like a good idea to knock out a little bit of work on Sunday so that you're not so slammed on Monday, even if it's just catching up an email or something, but don't do it. They say, you might be trying to kind of make time for your creative work, but you're actually just kind of stretching that work week out a little bit longer. It's never just a couple of emails. It's always a ton of them and a few more. By answering an email, you always risk someone writing you back. So there's that. So head to Bloomberg, my friends.
You could always just amend the email. Say, don't write me back. At the very end.
You know what? There's a free tool called Boomerang that I use that's really great. Because like I said, weekends are pretty work heavy for me and I send a lot of emails, but that drives people crazy. So on Boomerang, you can schedule when it will go. And then you can also schedule a reminder. So a ton of emails will go out for me like Monday, but I sent them Friday afternoon.
I like that.
Sunday or something. Yeah.
Interesting.
So there's that. Well, everybody head to Bloomberg.com and check out this story. They have really put a lot of thought. It is called Stop Monday from Ruining Your Sunday. It's all about how to hack your weekend to really decrease that anxiety. Couple that with our earlier segment about the mindfulness apps, and we are all about hacking the brain today. We'll be back in just a bit, though, and we're going to be talking about the Chicago real estate market and how some zip codes have recovered in very different ways than others after the housing market crashed nearly a decade ago. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you for spending part of your Saturday afternoon with me. I'm most grateful to you for that. My friends, still lots to do on the show. We are joined now by our good friend Dennis Rodkin. He's a real estate reporter at Crane's Chicago Business. Hi, Dennis. Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hi, Amy.
So there is some really great stuff at Crane's Chicago Business right now, all about in your area of expertise. And I'm always happy for you to be on the show with us and break it all down for us. There is a really interesting piece, though, taking a look at how different zip codes in Chicago have recovered very differently from the housing market crash about 10 years ago I'm hoping you can kind of discuss with us and break it down a bit more for us.
Okay. Well, housing prices peaked in the Chicago area in September 2006. So right now, October 2006, we're essentially celebrating the beginning of the downturn. It was a sort of slow, not terribly painful downturn for a while. And then in 2008, it really starts to plunge. So what I've done, so we use October 2006 as the starting point of that downturn. And we've done a couple of things. We have data on our site. I think you've seen it, where people can go and type in their zip code and see how it has performed in those 10 years and compare it to the region. There's a line for the Chicago region or to other zip codes. I do want to say this is data that comes from Case-Shiller, which is a highly regarded index. We didn't come up with the data. However, it is necessary to say Case-Shiller doesn't do DuPage County and doesn't do all of the other zip codes in the region. This is a single-family home index, so some people live – I can't think of which zip code it would be, but you live in a zip code that is primarily condos, it's not reflected in our chart. But that aside, almost anybody in the Chicago area can type in their zip code and, again, compare it to the region. And generally what you see is a lot of our zip codes waited a little while. They housing prices kept going up. They were affluent areas. They were areas without a lot of foreclosures, with very highly employed or a high rate of employment. So they took a while before they started down. But as you know, everybody eventually went down.
Yeah.
And then you see that there were some – I mean, we've talked about this before, and I've talked about it on WGN often – the South Side neighborhoods, the near South suburbs, some of those plunged so far. They have they still have an enormous climb to get back up even to where they were before the boom years. There are places that are still stuck in the 1990s, 10 years after the bust in the mid-2000s.
Yeah.
But then we've got like lakefront neighborhoods in the city, affluent neighborhoods just off the lakefront that are back above their old peak, that are doing far better than they were at the height of the boom in 2006.
Yeah. So it looks like 60610, which is primarily the Gold Coast area right here near Trinity Tower, that seemed like one of the best.
Yeah, we compared one of the – so we've got that chart I described, and then I also did a story where I looked at the two areas that are most and least recovered. And it happens that they're both in Chicago, but they are the most and least recovered in the region. So they're better than Lake and Cook suburbs and things like that. Mm-hmm. 60610 on the North Lakefront, on the near North Lakefront, Gold Coast, that is the most recovered. Prices are up more than 20% above where they were at the peak in 2006. Those are the kinds of numbers you're seeing in Portland and San Francisco and things like that, just in that neighborhood.
Okay.
60617 on the South Lakefront, essentially, if you cross the Skyway, 60617 is below you on both sides. That's the best way for people to imagine it. That is the least recovered in the region. Prices are still, home values are still 46% below where they were at the peak 10 years ago. And that's one of those places where prices are really, they're well below the values a couple of years before that. I don't know if they go back into the 90s. But prices have rolled backward from 2006 into a few years earlier than that. The point of saying that is if you bought your house in 2006 in 60617 on the South Side, it's worth so much less than it was. And it probably, because that is a modest neighborhood, was your only asset.
Yeah.
So the one thing that was going to build some form of wealth or security for you, maybe you were going to pull out equity to put kids through college or to help a senior citizen relative or something like that, it's just not performing for you.
While in
60610 up north, you were probably very affluent, had a lot of other assets that one wasn't your home wasn't performing real well for a while, but now it's doing great.
Yeah, and what a vast disparity, right? To repeat those numbers, it's 20% above in the Gold Coast area, 60610, and 46% below in 60617. What a huge range! What a 10 years later. Yeah, I mean that's like heartbreaking. I mean, imagine being in that situation. That's really like hard to swallow. And you also wrote about taking a look out of the city. You wrote about also a Naperville subdivision that really has kind of almost become a ghost town since that housing market crash.
Yeah, you know, I had the advantage, Amy, of having written about some houses in that subdivision when it first opened in 2006, wrote about it again during the recession and again in about 2011. So I had some history there. So when we were looking at what's happened in 10 years, I looked at a lot of the stories I did in 06 to see whether I could make a good comparison. And that was a good one. I'd just written about a house for sale there in 2006 in this subdivision in Naperville called Ashwood Park. It's on the far southwest rim of Naperville. It's about 8 miles from downtown Naperville, which gives you an idea of just how big that community is. And they were building, they were going to build several hundred houses, big clubhouse. It was really going to be a very fabulous place with a lot of homes priced in the $800,000 to over $1 million range. Some sold for $1.2, $1.4 million. And then the bust happened, and a whole lot of things have changed. Several hundred lots that would have been built by now have not been. One of the two developers of the subdivision went out of business, not only because of Ashwood Park, but because of being overextended with subdivisions all over that part of our region. The other developer sold off some lots, is selling houses for less than they were before. And so the subdivision, 10 years later, still has all these empty lots. There's a lot going on now. There's a whole lot of construction, but at lower prices. One whole swath of the subdivision is now what people in my business call production homes, subdivision homes, a builder who builds a lot of houses, as opposed to the individual customized house. So the whole subdivision looks different and looks emptier than was envisioned in 2006.
And so why is this new construction happening when we have all this empty real estate?
Well, there's still demand to buy in Naperville, and there's renewed demand. There's higher demand now than there was just a few years ago. New houses sell really well, and the people building them are able to build at a lower price point than the past houses that were built there because they're getting the empty lots at a discount. And again, in some cases, they're building smaller houses than they would have. So you're able to build and therefore sell at a lower price. And it's still an attractive area to be in. If you're a Napervillian, getting to Ashwood Park puts you into this, again, this place with this nice big clubhouse. There's either one or two new schools on the property. So it's an appealing place to be, and it will build out over time. It's just that the plan was for it to have been built out well before this 10-year mark, and it still is. I think I can't remember the figure, but it's about 2/3 built out after 10 years.
That's got to be hurting that developer so much. So if you are that developer, what is your strategy just to kind of sit on that and keep afloat until you see that full recovery?
Yeah, well, they are that. So the one developer went out of business, as I said, and all their land was sold to other developers. The one, the other half, the one that is still going, they've got other subdivisions happening. They've sort of rumbled back to life. Let's say they've got other subdivisions happening. They're building in Ashwood Park. They're selling in Ashwood Park. I did find prices are considerably lower than they used to be. But it was used also as sort of an example of what's going on in home building, not just that subdivision and not just Naperville. In Naperville itself, there used to be something like 80 at the boom years. There were about 85 home builders, and that shrank during the bust all the way to about a dozen, according to the city hall. It has grown back up. It's in the 2 to 3 dozen range, but all those people who were building houses had to go find something else to do, go build in Phoenix, something like that.
Yeah.
And so, that makes a mark on Naperville. Naperville has been developed by expanded by new homes for decades. And now you see this slowdown, not only, of course, in Naperville, but in all the western suburbs that were big subdivision areas. It's tough right now.
Yeah, it seems like the advice that we hear from personal finance experts about diversifying your portfolio just as much, is applicable to those developers for residential real estate, to just diversify and keep lots of different irons in the fire rather than put it all in one spot.
Yeah, I think, a lot of them are doing that now. One of the things we're seeing in home building now is what sells best is the infill houses, in a Glenview or an Elmhurst or someplace like that, where there is 1, 2, maybe 3 lots where one big old house came down or an old church, or for some reason there's an infill lot available. Those are selling far better than the subdivision houses out on the fringe. And, I think a lot of that is because of the rebirth of downtown and walkability and things like that. I'd rather be in a what did I just say, Elmhurst,
right,
in some cases, than Elburn, because I've got restaurants and movie theaters and all those kinds of things. So that's where a lot of home builders are focused now.
Yeah, it is interesting, too, to see how not only consumer tastes shift, but also how developers have responded to that and continue to respond and continue to kind of change in light of that economic recovery after the housing market bust.
Yeah, I think they've had to. Yeah, it was a big shakeout. I mean, there were other industries, of course, that were badly hurt, but home building was hurt in a big old way. You recall in 2006, there were subdivisions going in the city and elsewhere, big projects going on that all ground to a halt. But you've got this apparatus. You've got the employees, you've got the machinery, you've got the experience and the legal setup. You've got to roll forward. So people have, the ones who've survived are the ones who, as you say, diversified or pivoted.
Yeah.
You know, condos luxury apartments downtown are what a lot of builders are doing now.
Yeah.
And that's one reason is to follow that market.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it continues to change and shift. And of course, we will turn to you as ever at Crane's Chicago Business. Thanks so much, Dennis Rodkin, for joining us today.
Thanks, Amy.
Have a good one. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff. And instead of turning you over to King John, we're going to go to our good friend Sam Panionovich, and we're going to talk about sports instead today. That's what we're going to do. So back in just a bit on 720 WGN.